Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
As you know, Jen and I are very passionate about pelvic floor health, and we are so excited to invite a guest on our podcast talking about men's pelvic floor health and pelvic floor dysfunction across all gender identities. Dr. Lance Frank is a doctor of physical therapy who specializes in pelvic floor dysfunction across all gender identities. After earning his doctorate from Emory University in Atlanta, he opened his private practice, Flex PT ATL, located in Midtown Atlanta's vibrant LGBTQIA plus hub. As one of the few pelvic health therapists who has a penis, and one of an even smaller number of queer providers in the field, Dr. Lance brings a unique and deeply empathetic perspective to his care. As a member of the LGBTQIA plus community, he understands firsthand the discomfort many queer individuals feel when discussing vulnerable topics in medical spaces. He also recognizes how toxic masculinity can prevent people with penises from seeking help for pelvic pain, incontinence, and sexual dysfunction. Dr. Lance works with cis and trans men and women, though the majority of his caseload consists of patients with penises experiencing pelvic floor related concerns, such as urinary and bowel dysfunction, sexual health issues, and chronic pelvic pain. In addition to his clinical work, Dr. Lance is an active educator on social media where he breaks down stigmas and spreads awareness about sexual health and pelvic floor dysfunction. We absolutely love this interview and love bringing more light to this topic that everyone can experience pelvic floor dysfunction. Let's get into it.
Well, Dr. Lance, we are so excited to have you on the podcast. We said this when you were coming in today to chat, and just we've had a lot of female perspectives, I feel like, on pelvic health and really diving into so many topics on that, that we haven't navigated the world of those with a penis yet and what that really looks like with pelvic health and what we, you know, should be paying attention to. And sometimes I feel like it could be a little shameful or just not, it's just not a broad topic yet as much as for women. So I'm really excited to have you here today.
I am so excited to be here. Men's pelvic health is my entire career, so I have a lot of things to say about it. But yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, and I guess my first interest is like why this became your passion and why you wanted to go into this field specifically. I know Jen mentioned we've had a ton of women here that have talked about pelvic health, pelvic floor health, women's health specifically. And I was someone, Jen brought up the shameful side of men's pelvic health and men's pelvic dysfunction. Like I was someone in from I had a bilateral inguinal hernia when I was 17. And that was the initial sign that I was having a lot of pelvic lower core pressure management issues through my late 20s, you know, into my when I was around 30 years old before I started to really get a grasp after I met Jen and started actually working on my pelvic floor. Realized, hey, this is something that I don't have to live with. And the shameful side of having pelvic floor dysfunction and symptoms as a man is just like, it became a side passion of mine. It's not my primary area of focus, but very important to me as well. So why did it become important to you?
That's kind of a trick question. I did not go to PT school wanting to be a pelvic PT. It just sort of happened. I was on my orthopedic clinical rotation working with my CI, and she was both a pelvic PT and ortho. Like she had like 50% of her caseload was each. And so she was the one that really kind of introduced me to pelvic health, and she saw men and women in the clinic, and that was the first exposure to it. And then after that clinical, she actually, literally right after my clinical ended, she gave in her notice and started her own like small cash concierge practice. And after I graduated 2 years later, she offered me a job and basically was like, you know, I'd love to hire you. I think that you'd be a great PT to the clinic. But I'd love for you, would you be interested in exploring like having a niche, something like pelvic health? There aren't many men that have, there aren't many male therapists, and a lot of men have issues, and be a great way to market you and, you know, build a caseload, and you'd be the guy. And I was like, I mean, it's not exactly what I like went to school for, what like I'm interested in, but like, sure, why not? So I took the first Herman and Wallace pelvic floor course, and that was really when it kind of solidified just how many people I could help as a male therapist treating male pelvic floor dysfunction. And so that's really kind of where it started. I just sort of like stumbled into it. I didn't have this like passion or drive. I don't have like a fun backstory of like my own pelvic floor issues that like got me into it. It was really just a mentor that kind of suggested it. And then I kind of took it from there.
Taking a quick pause from the interview to talk about an aspect of health that many people aren't paying enough attention to, and that's their hydration. Now, we're not just talking about drinking enough water, but making sure you're getting in the electrolytes that your body dispenses without us even knowing it. And that's why Jen and I drink Element electrolyte mix packets every single day. They have the needed sodium, potassium, and magnesium to make sure your electrolytes are always at optimal levels. Why is this so important? Because those electrolytes are involved in so many physiologic functions that can help with our brain fog, fatigue, muscle cramps, sleep, even bowel movements, and so much more. So if you want to try Element and maybe get your hands on their lemonade salt, which is one of our favorite flavors, and we're so glad they're keeping it on indefinitely, go down to the link in the show notes. It's just drinkelement.com/optimal. That's drinkelement, spelled out LMNT.com/optimal. And you get a free gift with every single order. All right, let's get back into the interview.
Well, I mean, whatever kind of gets you along the journey to spark that passion, realizing how many people you can help, like that where, and the fact that you've leaned in so much to where I've found you on Instagram because of how you teach and how you promote and what you're talking about, I do think it is such a valuable topic right now that honestly, not a lot of men, I don't see a lot of male pelvic health providers, especially on social media. So, you know, like bravo to you for being willing to even dive in and explore that route. So let's talk about what is pelvic floor dysfunction? How does that typically present in men? And what are some of the signs, symptoms they could potentially be looking out for?
So I always, my like elevator pitch for pelvic, what is pelvic floor dysfunction is generally, you know, there's a group of muscles in the pelvis that for men or people with penises, they're mostly responsible for helping with our ability to pee, poop, have sex, and just create overall stability between the upper and lower halves of our bodies. And so when those muscles that sit inside of the pelvis, they can either be overactive or it, this is a very watered down explanation, I'm sure, as you know, but I always tell, this is how I explain it to patients, that the muscles can be overactive or working too hard, or they can be underactive or not, and or not working hard enough. And so for underactive patients, you know, I always joke, and again, most of the people that I work with are men or people with penises. And so I try to keep things lighthearted and joke around. And I say these, you know, when you think of somebody with an underactive pelvic floor, think of somebody, this is who, what most people think of whenever they think of pelvic floor physical therapy, somebody who's postpartum, somebody who's just given birth, somebody who might just need a little bit more strengthening to their tissues. Most of the people that I work with fall into the overactive pelvic floor category. And this is also where I make the joke. These are the tight asses. These are the type A, the highly stressed, the overly anxious, the people that just hold all of their stress in their pelvic floor and they just don't ever relax. They just walk around in a Kegel contraction all day long. And so, you know, these muscles should have the capability to contract and relax. But whenever they don't, that's when issues like issues with peeing and pooping and having sex and just some pain symptoms can start to come up. So that's kind of my elevator pitch for what I do.
Yeah, that was perfect. And we want the simplified version because it helps people click and connect like, oh, okay, that's what I have going on or what I need to pay attention to.
And so why do you think pelvic floor dysfunction goes so underdiagnosed in the male population and even amongst providers like myself? I mean, I was a PT for 2-3 years before I started to even think like, oh, maybe I need to work on my pelvic floor with the assistance of Jen, who's like, you need to start sitting on some balls and loosening up down there. And lo and behold, that did it. But why is it just something that men aren't even thinking of?
Well, I mean, to the layperson, most people don't even know that men have pelvic floors. So like most people think that this is a women's issue and that we just don't have any muscles down there that help with those basic functions. And so part of it's education, just the awareness that there are muscles down there. But even from a provider standpoint, there are, I've given so many presentations and lectures to different types of healthcare providers, and it's astounding, just especially physicians. I spoke at Ishwish a couple months ago, and it's the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. And so the conference is primarily for women's sexual health, but the bulk of the providers in there are urologists and gynecologists and obstetricians, and, you know, anybody that works in the sexual health domain was in this audience. And there was over 700 physicians in the audience. And when I first started the presentation, I asked, how many of you know that we have a group of muscles made up that are called the pelvic floor? And about half of the audience raised their hand. And then I asked another question, and the follow-up question, I was like, okay, so of those who raised their hand that have heard of the pelvic floor, know what it is, how many of you know that men have a pelvic floor? And about half of the people dropped their hands. And so a quarter of the audience, only a quarter of the 700 audience made up of physicians, actually knew that men have pelvic floors. And so the highest tier of our medical like hierarchy, if only 25% of the people really know that men have pelvic floors, and that like things can go wrong with them, like, it just, how is everyone else supposed to know that we have issues or those issues can happen?
That's crazy.
And so it was really kind of eye-opening whenever I, you know, asked those questions, because I always knew, just doing what I do and seeing, working with the patients that I work with, I knew that there was like this there was just lack of knowledge out there, but I didn't really know how vast it was. And so there's a lack of education, a lack of knowledge, but it's not just like from a patient facing perspective. It's like an everybody perspective. And so I don't know about you guys, but in my curriculum at Emory, we had one lecture and one lab about pelvic floor dysfunction, and it was for postpartum women. And at the, I remember thinking, sitting in that lab, being like, this, I don't ever want to work with that. Like, I don't, if this is what pelvic floor is, like, I'm good. Like, I don't, no, thank you. But it later, obviously, became more aware of what exactly pelvic floor therapy could look like. But yeah, I think there's just a lack of awareness. And honestly, that's why I started my social media page, because it just, I felt like there was nobody talking about it. And all of the information that was out there was targeted towards women. And most of the patients that, I mean, I would say 95% of my caseload is men with pelvic floor issues. And so I see a few women or like vulva owners, and I have a handful of trans patients, but the bulk of my patients are men. And so there's a lot of men out there that need help, but they're just, people get kind of stuck in this like medical loop where they, especially men, they go see their urologist, they're complaining of testicular pain or pain with sitting or pain after ejaculation. And, you know, they get prescribed all these antibiotics because they think it's an STI or a UTI or a prostate infection. And, you know, antibiotics work temporarily because they have anti-inflammatory properties, but they, once they stop taking the antibiotics, then symptoms come back. And so then they go back to their doctor, they get prescribed more antibiotics, and this loop that people get stuck in. And so once, whether they find me on, it's not just me also, there are more people talking about men's pelvic health out there, but there's not enough. And so whether it's people find me on YouTube or they find me on social media or through physicians that I've actually networked with that have referred patients to me, I'm often not the first provider or even the second provider that my patients have seen, just because of this lack of knowledge and awareness and this loop that people get stuck in.
Yeah, which is so unfortunate and proves how much work we have, we get to continue to do and advocate as physical therapists. You know, I think it's really interesting too, when we're thinking about the women pelvic health, male pelvic health, I think a lot of times too, would there be some hesitation as a male to go? Because you are assuming, well, for women, they're doing internal exams. So is that saying that they're going to do for men? I don't want that. And what if that's weird? And what if I'm seeing a woman? Like, what is the, can you talk through a little bit of the process for what a man can expect going to see a pelvic health therapist, and when is, would be more internal exams or, you know, be appropriate?
Yeah. Wow, you said a lot that I want to touch on, but I'm going to stick to your question. So when patients come in, I often get people after they've seen 2, 3, 5 other providers. And so by the time they get to me, most guys are pretty desperate and they're like, I don't care what you have to do. Just like do whatever you got to do to like help me. And, but obviously there is a level of anxiety about like what pelvic floor therapy is and what we do and how we do it. And so a lot of the people, or what I always explain to people is that like the group of muscles that I need to access, they sit inside of your pelvis. And really we can get to some of them on the outside, but the best way to actually assess them is on the inside. And, you know, yes, that means I have to stick a gloved finger up your rectum to assess them, but that's not, we can still make progress and I can still help you without going inside of your body. And so if people are like, I don't want anything up there, no, thank you. Like, I'm not going to force anybody to do anything that they don't want to do. I lay out how, you know, where the muscles are, and I have a little anatomy app and I go very in depth into like what each muscle is and what it's responsible for doing. And so they can see what muscles I'm talking about. And I have several pelvic models that I like bring out and I'm like, this is the muscles that I'm talking about and this is how I need to access them. And so I explain that, like, you know, there could be an internal exam depending on the symptoms that you're coming in for. Some of your symptoms might be coming from these muscles inside of the pelvis that are best assessed internally. But, you know, whenever patients come in to see me, there's always some degree of a subjective intake. So we talk for about 25, 30, 45 minutes. My evaluations are 2 hours. A lot of guys have a lot of things to say. And most of the time, the first visit, all we do is talk. Like they've never had anybody listen to them and like be able to share their whole experience. And so a lot of the times the first half of the evaluation is just talking. And so after that, I go through what I call a movement screen where I just functionally observe how they're moving in their body. And then we go through an orthopedic exam where we're just assessing strength and range of motion and flexibility. Generally I keep it to like the hips and the low back. And then I do a palpation exam where I'm just feeling all of the muscles and seeing if anything is tight or painful or has any sort of trigger points, fascial restrictions. And then we move into the pelvic exam. And that's usually when I say, you know, the first thing that we're going to look at is how your breath relates to the pelvic floor. And a lot of people with an overactive, a very tight pelvic floor have some breathing dysfunctions without going through the whole like mechanism. I do a breathing assessment with people and see what their pelvic floor is doing. Then there's an external palpation exam just to kind of see again if any of the muscles are tight, tender, or painful. And then that's usually when we go, if it's appropriate and if it's necessary and if they're okay with it, then we move into an internal exam. And so the internal exam, it gives me a lot of information about what they're able to do with their body, if they're able to relax it, if they have any trigger points that are recreating any of their familiar symptoms. And after that, then we kind of talk about what a therapy plan would look like in the future. Like, would it involve more internal work? Can I achieve what I need to achieve by staying external? I know you guys are in close to LA in California, but in Georgia, we have dry needling. So a lot of muscle work that I could do internally could also be gotten to externally by doing some dry needling in there. And so there are ways to get at some of these structures without actually going inside of somebody, but sometimes it's just easier and more efficient to treat somebody if I can. So it just kind of depends on the patient and the conditions that they're coming in with.
I think that's great. And I'm glad you brought up the breath. It's something that I know Jen talks about a ton when it comes to where to start with people, because if you have breath dysfunction, I don't think again, the diaphragm, something that we feel like in the world of physical therapy is it's obvious everyone has a diaphragm, but you start talking about diaphragm and proper breathing techniques, and it's so foreign to many people how we actually should be breathing. And then when people start to understand the relationship between that diaphragm and pelvic floor, and how it's essentially the top and bottom of your core canister, and if those two aren't working in synergy, we're going to have, you know, it's no surprise that you might be having some problem. And I see the sign on your wall behind you that says inhale, exhale.
Yeah.
And it prompted me to be like, oh, I need to ask him about breath. So I'm glad that you touched on that. But I want to jump into something juicy. Like, let's start talking about, let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about when people are, you brought up some things, like people might be having pain when they get an erection or pain with ejaculation. Why might that be something that's happening?
just going back to that blanket, like very watered down explanation of what's going on, the muscles of the pelvic floor, if they're in that overactive hypertonic state, it's kind of like if you have a Charlie horse in your calf, would you then go run a marathon or even a 5K? Like, probably not. Like, the muscles are tight, they're angry, they're pissed off. Like, the last thing you'd want to do is work them even harder. And the muscles, specifically the superficial, the muscles closer to the surface and the perineum, those muscles are responsible for ejaculation or erections, or they have to be able to relax for bowel movements and urination. And so there's one tiny little muscle that wraps around the shaft of the penis and the perineum called the bulbospongiosis. And if somebody has pain with ejaculation or pain with erections, the way that we as men or people with penises ejaculate or have an orgasm, those muscles have to contract very vigorously, very rapidly to stimulate this reflex in our brain that tells our body, hey, it's go time. It's time to release. And so when those muscles contract very vigorously and they're already in that overactive, that hypertonic state, it kind of creates a Charlie horse just in your perineum, in your penis. And so it causes pain. And a lot of times people have soreness and pain afterwards. Same thing with erections. Those same muscles, there's actually two of them, bulbospongiosis and ischiocavernosis are the two main like ejaculation erection muscles. And those two muscles, when they're overworked, they go into a spasm and then it causes pain. And so I have a lot of patients that have either pain with erections or pain after erections or pain after ejaculation. Sometimes I'll have pain, or patients will say, like, during the process of ejaculating, like it's this like weird sensation of like it hurts, but also like orgasms are supposed to be like pleasurable, and so like there's this like pleasure sensation followed by this like sharp like aching pain sensation.
Yeah,
it's pretty interesting.
Yeah,
definitely. And so, you know, just for people and wanting to understand, that's where, you know, getting in with a pelvic health therapist, potentially assessing muscles internally and externally, and then providing, you know, a structured plan. Like, what does that typically look like, you know, in terms of, am I supposed to be going all the time for physical therapy? How often do I have to now implement this whole new exercise routine? Can I still exercise and lift heavy? You know, because a lot of people are now afraid, okay, if I'm saying that something is overactive, am I not supposed to be living my everyday life? Like, what does that kind of look like?
I always tell my patients that a lot of people are great about, you know, people are motivated to want to work out. People are motivated to want to be healthy. A lot, especially a lot of my patients, a lot of the guys that I work with, they're very like successful, very driven, very motivated people. But if you're just constantly in overdrive all the time and you don't ever take time to like reset, like, of course your body's gonna, it's, pain is our signal that, you know, we're doing the most. And if we're not swinging the pendulum in the opposite direction and focusing on mobility, and we're not focusing on flexibility, if we're not focusing on down training our system at all, and we're only focused on up training, like, eventually, you know, the gas is going to run out. And so I always tell people, like, movement is medicine, motion is the lotion. The last thing that I want you to do is to stop moving. But I also want you to be mindful, you know, I'm going to give you some breathing exercises, and I want you to implement that throughout the day. And especially after a workout, I'm going to show you a few mobility drills and some flexibility, some stretches that I want you to implement, you know, do a warm up before you go max out on deadlifts, and then really spend some time on some breath work and some mobility work after your, you know, intense workout. The last thing that I want people to do is to stop moving, because that's just, we know that that's not going to help anything. But everything in moderation. And if we're only focusing on strength and we're not focusing on flexibility and mobility work, like, that's where problems, in my opinion, tend to arise. And so a lot of my home programs, like, whenever I start working with people, I don't take insurance. I'm in an out of network model. And just for some people, just maximizing time and resources and money, like, I generally only see people once a week. And then I build out a home program for them that I want them to incorporate in the other 6 days of the week that we're not together. And assuming that they're progressing the way that I want them to, I start people on like a once a week program, and then we can kind of space it out to every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, every month, so on and so forth, until they get to a place where they're like, Lance, I'm good. Like, I'm Gucci. I don't need you anymore. Thanks for your services. And so a lot of people's home programs consist of mobility work, some like self myofascial release work, like, especially if they need internal work outside of what we're doing in the clinic, like, I'll send them home with something called a pelvic wand, or depending on the condition, I might send them home with a rectal dilator to help just kind of give some like stretch to the tissues. but it's a lot of mobility and flexibility work, a lot of breath work, just to kind of help turn down the dial on their nervous system a little bit.
Yeah, that's huge.
I think that's great. And I mean, I love that model. And I just wish that was something that we could focus on in general as health providers, rather than having these different clinics or providers who are like, I need you in person 3 times a week.
Only doing
for
this.
8 weeks or 12 weeks. And especially when you bring up not taking away someone's exercise and how important that can be, because if someone's already having pain and then you take away something that brings them joy, I don't think people can, I don't think people fully understand how making small changes to what you're already doing can make vast change over time, can make a significant change over a 6 to 12 week period. So, what else can we talk about here?
Well, something that I wanted to ask about, like some specific questions when it comes to types of masturbation that men do. Are there things that, you know, can start to create potential issues based on what you're doing? So I know there's things called edging that you've kind of talked about. I've heard you talk about. So can you like talk about some specifics that could potentially drive us into some pelvic floor issues?
Yeah. Edging is a big one. And it's one that I don't know how common it is for people, like if people like are super familiar with it, but in my line of work,
explain what it is.
Yeah. Well, edging essentially for somebody with a penis or men is masturbating to the point of almost ejaculating without actually allowing the release of it. So like you get to that like point of no return, but stop yourself. And so that buildup over time, you know, I have some patients where they'll just like edge themselves for 20, 30, an hour more plus sometimes. And if you think about what I said earlier about how we as people with penises ejaculate or have an orgasm, those muscles, that buildup of those contractions is what triggers that reflex. And so people are pushing that point of like orgasm without actually allowing themselves the release and like the downside of it. Over time, that can push people into an overactive hypertonic state, and their muscles will literally go into a spasm and or get trigger points that cause pain whenever they do ejaculate. I've had so many patients that have come in after like a long, prolonged session of edging, and then now every time they have an orgasm, their perineum hurts or hurts to sit. I would say other tendencies, precipitating factors, if you want to call them that, towards like somebody developing pelvic floor dysfunction is people who do a lot of straining, like sitting on the toilet, whether they're peeing or pooping, and just like really strain to get things out. Most people think that when they're straining, they're using their muscles to push things out. But a lot of times, like if I'm doing an internal exam and I tell somebody, okay, show me what you do when you strain, 8 times out of 10, they're actually squeezing the hell out of my finger and they're pulling it up deeper inside of them. And so most people think that when they're straining, they're opening and they're relaxing, but they're actually just tightening things even more. And so it's really hard to push something out of something whenever you're tightening it, when it's supposed to, you know, open and lengthen and relax. I also see, you know, again, going back into like precipitating factors, people, we already kind of touched on this, but people that are like super into whatever sort of like workout that they do, whether it's CrossFit, whether it's, you know, jujitsu, whether it's running marathon, like people that just are super into their like craft or their like their exercise, that just don't ever like, you know, let their foot off the pedal, that are just always in like go mode. Yeah. And, you know, if people don't really pay attention to mobility work, if they're not paying attention to their breath, they're just constantly holding their breath, or, you know, it doesn't bode well for pelvic floor dysfunction symptoms.
You mentioned the toilet, and we had a question about that, because I think it's common for people, especially in the day of streaming or doom scrolling on social media, to just be sitting on the toilet for 15, 20, 30 minutes. And while you might not be straining, can that still also be something that's detrimental?
I mean, I hear this all the time from women, like, oh, my husband is going to be like forever.
Yeah, he went to the bathroom. He'll be back in an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it puts a lot of downward pressure into the pelvic floor, and nobody knows exactly what people are doing whenever they're going to the bathroom. But if they're just going in there to get a little peace of mind and like some quiet time to like doom scroll, and you know, it probably isn't the best for your pelvic floor. But if you're not like straining, and if you're not like pushing, and you're not doing what I just said, like there's no reason that having a bowel movement should take longer than 5 minutes. So if it does, you know, I would question like, what's actually happening? What's going on with your body? Why does it take so long to get things out? Because that shouldn't happen. It's kind of the same thing with urinating, is when we stand in front of a urinal or a toilet, it should just sort of start flowing. Things should just sort of come out. And if it doesn't, you know, that's a condition called urinary hesitancy. And it could be a function of the pelvic floor muscles just not relaxing enough to allow things to come out. And so if people are sitting on the toilet for a long time and it takes a long time to start a bowel movement, or it takes a long time to initiate a urine stream, like I would consider that some degree of pelvic floor dysfunction if they're not able to relax the way that their bodies just reflexively should relax to evacuate. Yeah.
Now I want to go back a little bit also to masturbation. Let's just dive in on all the sex things.
Perfect.
So we talked about, you know, pain with ejaculation or different types of masturbation. When it comes to potentially someone feeling like, well, maybe I need more strength because I just can't get there. I can't get hard, or I can't stay hard. Could that also be a area of pelvic floor dysfunction?
Also a trick question. It depends. Okay. And I hate that answer, and I hate giving that answer, but it really does depend. If patients
classic physical therapist answer.
I know. It really used to like annoy me in PT school when I'd ask a question and our professor would say, it depends. But now I really kind of understand. But it does depend. I'm going to divide this up for a second. If we're just talking about like erections and erectile difficulties, there's so many areas in which things can go wrong where it could be a pelvic floor issue. It could be a pelvic floor weakness issue or a pelvic floor overactivity issue, but it could also be a blood flow issue. It could be a hormonal issue. It could be you're just not getting enough sleep. It could be a muscle function, but a lot of times there are other avenues that could be explored that might explain why you're not able to get or maintain an erection. With that being said, if patients are coming in and they have, you know, prostatitis, or they have this overactive pelvic floor that we're talking about, and it hurts to get an erection, or it hurts after they ejaculate, a lot of times it's going to create this fear avoidance behavior where their anxiety is going to prevent them from getting an erection because they know it's going to be painful, or it prevents them. They might be able to get an erection, but they might not be able to ejaculate because their brain has been wired to associate pain with ejaculation. And so they might not be able to ejaculate. And so if there are precipitating factors like pain that are creating this like fear avoidance, then that can create some ED or some ejaculation issues. But when it's purely ED, I'm really hard pressed to say that of pelvic floor dysfunction, you know, I might put my foot in my mouth here, but people are always like, I want a stronger erection, so I must need to do, I should do more Kegels. And the strength of our erections, yes, it does involve the pelvic floor muscles being able to trap blood into the shaft of the penis, but it also has to depend on your blood flow and how much blood is actually getting into the penis. And so there could be a vascular issue. There could just be a lack of blood flow. A lot of people will get prescribed like a Viagra or a Cialis. And that's one of the questions that I ask in my intake. If they're coming in for ED, I always ask, do you take any sort of Viagra or Cialis? And if they do, and they say that their erections are better, in my head, I'm like, okay, well, those medications dilate your blood vessels. They allow more blood flow to get into the penis. And so this might just be a blood flow issue, not necessarily a muscle weakness issue. But again, with a caveat, if there are other symptoms, specifically pain symptoms, that are limiting their erections, then it might be a muscle issue. Same thing with ejaculation. You know, I have treated several guys who they've had a condition called anorgasmia, or delayed ejaculation, where their body just like, their body just doesn't get them to the point of an orgasm or ejaculation. And again, sometimes it could be a hormonal issue. Sometimes it could be a chemical issue. Now I'm going to blank on the hormone, dopamine and serotonin. I have a lot of guys that will go on, you know, they're on SSRIs. And so sometimes that, like, that level of like chemical regulation can impact their orgasms. But assuming that's not the case, if from a pelvic floor standpoint, if we go back to what I said about, you know, how we as people with penises have orgasms or ejaculate, if their pelvic floor muscles aren't strong enough to trigger that reflex in our brain that it's go time. I had a couple guys where it's like, yeah, I could have like masturbate or have sex for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, and like, it's just not going to happen. And so it could be a function of a pelvic floor weakness issue. I feel like I just went on a tangent there. Did that answer your question?
No, that was good. I mean, I think being able to distinguish as well between what you're kind of looking out for and taking a whole look at the person, like, that is the key here.
It just brings up in general the complexity mm-hmm. of the situation when people are having issues, and when it has to do with something as intimate as sex or intercourse and struggling with being able to do that in whatever capacity. All the things that can be involved that you just listed off from yes, pelvic floor dysfunction to hormonal regulation to blood flow issues to just like the excitability of us to be able to get in that state of being ready to have sex and the dopamine and serotonin release that's required. And so being able to have a professional to help sort through that a bit is and tell people, like, there are so many people that go through this and you are taking the step to start finding your solution. Is so empowering. One question that I have that I thought of was, when you go to PT school, you start looking at the world through a PT lens and you start seeing people do things, whether it's out in public, whether it's just sitting, or whether it's a friend or family members in the room, that you're like, oh, if you do that too often, it might impact your pelvic floor health. Or are there those things that you will see people do that you can just point out and say, like, yep, if that's a habit, it could start to, you know, impact your pelvic health or, you know, develop a dysfunction?
That's a good question. Gosh, I'm sure there are being put on the spot. My brain just went blank. I would say, I mean, it's kind of all of the things that we already know, like people that just, if they're not lifting, if they're not working out, if they're not eating healthy. This is kind of a cop-out answer, but the people that also, and you can pick these people out in your life, the people that are just like always just like tense as hell, they're always just like kind of on edge, always just a little bit over anxious about something. Those are the people where I'm like, I bet you have some kind of pelvic floor issue going on there.
I know Jen always talks about just standing with your butt cheeks clenched, or the people who hang out with like their butt clenched all the time.
But like you said, like, just someone who's probably a little bit more high rung.
Yeah. People that are just generally just a little high strung for about everything. Like, those are the people where I'm like, we gotta turn your dial down a bit. Let's focus on some breath work. But yeah, if I think of anything else, I'll come back to that.
Yeah,
for sure.
Now, you've mentioned prostatitis as well, and I assume it's probably a diagnosis that a lot of men have received. Especially just talking about the prostate in general, like, how does that relate to pelvic health? Because like you kind of alluded earlier in the conversation about just receiving medications and that working to a certain degree, but not fully. So at what point does someone start to say, okay, if I'm feeling this or I've been diagnosed with this, do I ask right away? Like, okay, sure, give me the medication, but do I also ask for pelvic floor PT?
So, yes, and prostatitis is a condition where the prostate is inflamed because of some bacterial infection. There's four categories of prostatitis. Three of them involve a bacterial infection, and the fourth one doesn't. But 95% of prostatitis diagnoses are actually the non-bacterial type. And so the surefire way to know whether this is a true prostate infection or a pelvic floor dysfunction issue is there a bacterial infection? And a lot of times people will say, you know, it hurts when I pee, it hurts when I ejaculate, it hurts to sit. and they'll do the most, the first line step for any of those symptoms is a urine screen or a semen culture. And so assuming they do one of those tests, they're either going to find a bacterial infection or they're not. And if they do, a round of antibiotics should fix it and they should be asymptomatic after, you know, a couple of weeks. If they don't find a bacterial infection, a lot of guys will still get put on antibiotics. And that's where this like false positive starts to happen, where their symptoms will get better because of the anti-inflammatory properties of antibiotics. And then once they stop taking them, symptoms come back. And so I'm not a physician. I can't diagnose and I can't legally prescribe, but I always tell my patients, you know, take the first round of antibiotics. Just to, you know, some bacterial infections that don't come up on urine screens and semen cultures. Like you have to do like a deep dive of like a 30, 40 panel, like infectious test to pick them up. And so sure, like take the first round of antibiotics, see how you feel after you finish. If symptoms come back, that's when I would start probing, you know, could this be a muscle problem? Could this be a pelvic floor issue? And this is where just the education of the medical system sometimes can go awry here, because if the physician doesn't even know that pelvic floor dysfunction could be causing some of these prostatitis-like symptoms, then they don't know to prescribe patients to pelvic floor physical therapy. And so I've done so many, like, I don't really do them anymore because I just don't have time for it. But when I was first starting out and I first started my business, I went to so many different urology offices and like told people what I did and what I could help with. And the amount of physicians that just were like, that's witchcraft. Like that's hocus pocus. Like that's bullshit. Essentially, they were like that. No, that doesn't work. Okay, sure. But the number of physicians that had that belief was just kind of crazy. And so if the physicians don't even know that pelvic PT is a thing and that it can help some of these guys, then it's not the patient's fault. But that's when they could start probing and they could start questioning their physician. You know, say they listen to this podcast or they're Googling their symptoms and they find a YouTube video that I or somebody else has done. Like that's when it would be appropriate to be like, hey, I kind of want to explore this avenue. Can you write me a prescription?
Those physicians are probably the same ones that are in line with the OBs who just tell their mothers who just gave birth, like, yep, just wait 6 weeks and then you can go back to activity. Like,
yeah,
it just the things that don't make sense. And I'm sorry, I'm sure some of those physicians are good people, but I can't wait until that generation retires and we can start moving into like really advancing how we approach people who are having pelvic floor dysfunction. Because yeah, that just sounds silly. And like you said, it makes me shake my head as well.
It is really kind of interesting. I mean, I've really only been active and like on social media really since COVID in terms of like my profession and like this specialty. It kind of coincided. Like I started my business and then I became active on social media. And as I was growing my business, I did a lot of like in-person like networking and like meeting different physicians. And at the same time was growing this like social media, like platform. And the response that I would get from some of the local physicians that were just kind of should just kind of like old school ways of thinking. And then patients that would find me I met so many people that I have done like a virtual consult with that were like, yeah, my urologist saw you on TikTok or they saw you on Instagram and told me that I should try to set up a consult with you. Like just the different like levels of thinking and like openness from across the generations and like who is consuming information and where. Not to say that I'm like the end all be all and I know everything when it comes to pelvic floor dysfunction, but like I feel like I know a good bit at this point and I feel pretty competent. And so if somebody sees me on social media, hopefully they would trust me enough to like at least listen to me. But yeah, it's interesting how some ways of thinking are just haven't evolved, but that's kind of with everything.
Right. And hopefully it continues to progress. Now, there are two more things I just wanted to quickly ask about because understanding like where, you know, I might need to get a little bit of help or attention or what are signs. When it comes to someone complaining about hemorrhoids or hernias, especially like inguinal hernias, are these signs and symptoms that potentially something could be going on with the pelvic floor? And should someone probably go get assessed with that?
Yes. Short answer is yes. Sometimes hemorrhoids are just a function of, you know, you had a bad diet for a week, or you were sick, or, you know, sometimes they're just kind of one-off instances. But I have a lot of patients where it's like, no, I get like chronic hemorrhoids. Like I get one every couple months and I have to go get it surgically banded. And so hemorrhoids, like a lot of times to that degree, are something where I'm like, yeah, there's definitely a pressure management issue happening that you should probably get checked out. Same thing with hernias. If somebody has like an inguinal hernia, even a diastasis, I have some guys that have like a diastasis because their rectus abdominis is separate. Like that's a pressure management issue for sure. That whether it's a core weakness or a pelvic floor like issue, like probably needs to be assessed. I think what would be helpful, and I don't want to like misguide the question that you just asked, but if I just went through a quick kind of like down and dirty, like symptoms that I typically see in terms of like men that come in with pelvic floor dysfunction.
Love that.
So I'm just going to go through the categories that I like: peeing, pooping, having sex, and just like pain complaints. So from a urinary standpoint, it's, you know, urinary hesitancy, taking a while to start a stream, post void dribbling, more than just like a drop or two. Like if you're like wetting your underwear, wetting your outerwear, like that's definitely a pelvic floor issue. Urinary urgency or frequency. A lot of people will say like, I just have a shy bladder or a small bladder. I just have to pee all the time. I've always been that way. It's probably could be a pelvic floor issue. Straining to have to urinate or waking up excessively in the middle of the night could also be a pelvic floor issue. Something called nocturia. Pain with urination obviously is not normal. Could be a pelvic floor dysfunction issue. Not emptying all the way, just like feeling like there's still something in there, or what's called incomplete urination or urinary retention. In terms of like from a bowel health standpoint, like I said, hemorrhoids, chronic hemorrhoids, fissures, like I describe them as like paper cuts in your rectal canal, your rectum, that just can be painful. Having to strain or like chronic constipation. There's a condition called outlet dysfunction where the pelvic floor muscles just tighten whenever they should relax. And so people can't defecate successfully. Pain with bowel movements. From a sexual standpoint, specifically for men or people with penises, you know, we talked about erectile dysfunction. There are caveats to that, but ED could be a pelvic floor dysfunction issue. Same with ejaculation, delayed ejaculate, anorgasmia, delayed ejaculation, premature ejaculation. There are also caveats to premature ejaculation, but could be a pelvic floor dysfunction issue. Pain with ejaculation, pain with erections, I would say. Or, you know, again, I mostly see men, but, and we haven't really talked about sexuality, not that it should matter, everyone has a butthole, but pain with receptive penetration is also something that I treat, that specifically in men, that could be a function of pelvic floor dysfunction issues. And then just general pain complaints. So like hip pain, low back pain, lower abdominal pain, testicle pain, perineal pain, pain with erections, pain with ejaculation. Those are all, I would say, the more common pain symptoms that I treat that could be pelvic floor related.
No, that's perfect. I love having that, especially as an ending of like, okay, these are all the things to kind of look out for, and something that you can take proactive care once you start noticing that something's happening, rather than allowing it to go so long or chronically, you know, have to deal with some of these things. And as a mother to two boys,
and people who want to continue to help bridge this gap and fill this gap in pelvic health.
I mean, as a mother to two boys, like it's important for me to understand as well, and hopefully other people who might be raising young men or men with, or young adults with penises can start to understand this as well. So, when should you start paying attention with your young boys? Like,
or educating them,
or educating, like, what do you kind of recommend?
That's a great, great question. I always tell people that, like, if some of these issues were discussed as children, like school aged, like a lot of adulthood issues could be prevented, you know, chronic hemorrhoids, chronic fissures, like learning how to poop without straining, and elevating your knees and going through the breath work. And same thing with peeing. And like, I've seen a couple at pediatrics is not my specialty, and I don't actively market for peds, but I have seen a couple peds patients in my clinic, and I've always just like applauded the parents at like being proactive at bringing them in, because, you know, issues in adulthood are probably going to be prevented. And it's kind of like, I feel the same way about pelvic health as I do about sexual health. You know, I don't know about you guys as high school or like middle school, but in sixth grade, we like watched a video, and that's when like the conversations about sex ed kind of started to talk or started happening. And I think even, you know, around that age or younger, just starting to pay attention to like, is it taking a while for my kid to like have a bowel movement? Is his underwear wet whenever he finishes peeing? Is he getting everything out? I think a lot of these issues in adulthood could be prevented if there's more information about it in our adolescence years.
Yeah,
absolutely totally agree. And I mean, this has all been so incredible, and it's been amazing finally having someone on to speak to the male side of pelvic health. Mm-hmm. And so we really appreciate that and appreciate the work that you do. I know you have a course. You mentioned doing virtual consults with people. Is that something you still do? Can you tell us where people can find your course and where they can learn more from you or even work with you?
I do virtual consults with people. Like, I'm active on social media. And so people, I've done consults with people from all over the world that they don't have a pelvic PT nearby, or they have some symptoms, but they're not sure if they could benefit from pelvic PT. I do offer virtual consults where people can schedule. I am in the process of, there will be a course released for, it's a kind of a DIY male pelvic pain course, kind of help to at least jumpstart people if they don't have a pelvic PT nearby, things that they can start working on to help address some of these symptoms that we talked about today with pelvic floor dysfunction. So it'll be ready soon.
I'm so excited. And of course, we're going to have it linked up. We're going to have your Instagram, isn't it? Lance in Your Pants.
Lance in Your Pants. Yeah.
I love that name, by the way.
That's fantastic.
I was like, is this too like on the nose? Is this too like inappropriate? But you know what? I try to keep things lighthearted and make things approachable.
Yeah, definitely. You do that. It's perfect. I've really enjoyed this conversation. You're very knowledgeable. You're helping a lot of people. And, you know, in an area that I believe is also underserved. So thank you so much for the work you do and for spending time with us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me. This has been fun.
Absolutely loved having Dr. Lance on this podcast to raise this awareness. If you know that you have other men in your life that could listen to this podcast with an open mindset and just learn about their bodies, please pass this episode along. We don't get this information out without your help. So please pass the information along. If you haven't left a review, please leave us a review in whatever app that you listen to podcasts, because it helps us get the reach out to other people so much more. And we're going to keep delivering more episodes. So I hope we see you back on the next episode of the Optimal Body Podcast.